Nick.
Yeah. I'm a professor from the math department at Oxford University. I'm really, really pleased that we didn't have the invitation to come. Nick started off in applied mathematics at Harvard with a BSc degree. They got a PhD in computer science at Stanford, and he's kind of oscillated back and forth between applied math and computer science. He then went off and did kind of a postdoctoral fellowship, a stint anyway, to the Columbia Institute in New York City. I joined the faculty at MIT in applied mathematics. I don't know how many years he stayed there, but then moved on to Cornell in computer science, and recently, in 97, moved and became head of the numerical analysis group at Oxford. And Nick, we're really delighted to have you come here, and looking forward to your talk on fast, accurate solutions of stiff PDE.
Okay, thank you. Here. Maybe we should turn off these lights. Yeah, that's great. Okay. Well, it's nice to be here, and I have a bunch of old friends around, and some people here I haven't met that might be relevant. Like, well, Steve Ruth is certainly relevant. Is Brian Wetton here? So, okay, so both of these guys know more about this subject than I do, as does Uri Asher, but he's not here, right? So there are at least two people here. Michael Ward also probably knows more about it than I do. My goal is to know more about it than average in the room, and maybe I can achieve that. I want to talk about some work with a student, Ali Kassam, who is the first ever PhD student funded by the MathWorks, that is the MATLAB company. And it's about how to compute solutions to certain stiff PDEs. I'll tell you what that means. And a lot of it is comparing different methods, but the truth is I'm going to advocate a particular method. So really the talk is about telling you about a method that works very beautifully and is very easy to use, fast and accurate, called ETDRK4, which stands for Exponential Time Differencing Runge-Kutta 4. And it was essentially invented by Cox and Matthews at the University of Nottingham in the UK, although we had a part in it too, and in making it numerically workable. So, to begin with the introduction, this is the kind of partial differential equation we're going to talk about, and a lot of equations fall into this pattern. You know, maybe half of all the PDEs that people care about in the world can be described this way. In practice, differential equations usually mix various terms, and very often they mix a linear term of high order, which it might be some kind of diffusion, with a nonlinear term, typically of lower order, which is some kind of reactive or convective or other effects. This is a rather short list of examples. One can literally give hundreds of examples of such equations. But, for example, this is something Michael Ward knows everything about, the Allen-Kahn equations. Kordoveig de Vries with solitons. Ah, so we have to digress. There are three partial differential equations that have won Nobel Prizes. Who can name one of them? Well, you're a good test taker, because you noticed I paused. This is one of them, the equations of neuron conduction. Okay, there are two more.
Schrodinger.
Who answered? Who are you? Schrodinger is one, a linear Schrodinger, and Black Scholes. I'm very impressed. Those are the three, I think. Anyway, Hodgkin-Huxley is in this category. Fisher KPP, another one. Fitsunagumo related to Hodgkin-Huxley. Kuramoto-Sivashinsky, I'll be talking about a little bit. The famous Berger's equation, Gray-Scott equations. Nonlinear Schrodinger would fit this picture. And, of course, the most important PDE of all in terms of the amount of interest the human race has given to it is the Navier-Stokes equations. And they do fit this pattern because you have the viscous terms and the convective terms. So, one needs to solve such problems. I'm going to show one picture now of, just to give a hint of the kind of complicated behavior that is encompassed by such problems. This is the wonderful Kuramoto-Sivashinsky equation. Some of you look at these and instantly see what's going on, others don't, but it's a time-dependent equation, of course, and this is the sort of term that would form a shock on its own. It's nonlinear. And then you have two diffusive terms, But the signs are such that this one is unstable. It's a backwards heat equation type of term, whereas this one is stable. And in the interplay of the unstable and the stable diffusion, you get this wonderful chaotic behavior. That's time going this way, space this way. You start with some very simple initial condition, and you can see this wonderfully complex behavior evolving from there. So that's just one solution of one of the equations I'm talking about, but you can see that we're talking about numerical methods for modeling potentially very complicated problems. Moreover, a lot of these problems have sensitive dependence on the data. This is one of them. If you change the initial conditions by a very small amount, you'll change the picture completely. So if you want to know how the equation is really behaving, you need a high accuracy method. We're going to come back to that equation later on. Okay, so we have this problem of numerically solving a PDE that mixes these two types of terms. The challenge is that the two types of terms impose different problems. A high-order linear term tends to give you stability problems because of the domains of dependence and all that stuff. If you just do the obvious discretization of one of these terms, you'll have an unstable method, unless you have microscopic step sizes. So you need some kind of implicit discretization or the moral equivalent, an exact solution of some kind, to get around the stability problem with L. On the other hand, the nonlinear term tends not to have these fast speeds of propagation that cause stability problems. On the other hand, it's nonlinear, and that brings in a whole different set of problems. To solve anything nonlinear, you probably have to iterate if you want it exactly. So an implicit solution of this term tends to be more trouble than it's worth. So one tends to look for methods that somehow do different things with L and N to combine implicit and explicit behavior. Now, I'm a spectral methods person, so as far as I'm concerned, the space discretization is going to be trivial. If you're on a simple domain, like an interval or a square, you just use a Fourier or a Chebyshev spectral method, and you have wonderful high accuracy with respect to space. That wouldn't be true for a more complicated domain, but on a simple domain, that's easy. So we're going to assume that the space discretization is taken care of by some kind of spectral method. And really, the name of the game is how to do the time discretization to get high accuracy. Well, you can see in red that what I'm going to talk about is fourth-order accuracy. If you look at the thousands upon thousands of computations people have done for problems like these, I'm sure that less than 1% would have higher than second-order accuracy in time. But if you really want to get a solution that's correct for a chaotic or semi-chaotic problem, you might need more than that. Now, the six methods I'm going to say a word about, I've given abbreviations to. So this is the one that there's a beautiful UBC paper about, linearly implicit methods. All of them have several names, I'm afraid. Integrating factors, split steps, sliders. This is the one that I'm going to focus on mostly, deferred correction. I want to show you a few comparisons of these methods, give you a hint of what each one's about. Obviously, I won't go into detail. And then focus on this particular scheme. And what I really love in life is complex analysis. So the reason I like this formula so much is you can't do it properly unless you know complex analysis. Okay, so let's say a word about these six types of methods. Now, I have to tell you that I chose which things on these slides to put in red ink independent of the audience. So the fact that the UBC paper is in red ink, it's real. This is really a very nice paper. So of all the methods, I think this is the one that has had the most attention over the years, that's been used in the greatest variety of ways and the greatest variety of problems. These are a few references, and I'm sure you guys know more than I do. But roughly speaking, the idea of these methods is to do just what you might have guessed from a couple of slides ago, discretize your PDE on a grid, but use different types of formulas for L and N. And of course, we want some kind of implicit formula, like a backward differentiation formula for L, and some kind of explicit formula for N, so you don't have to iterate to solve a nonlinear equation. So what do you guys call these methods? Linearly implicit or
implicit?
Right, that's right. Okay, I forgot what it was. Are there other names, too, that come to mind?
Well, I've heard this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Anyway, somehow you're blending this different types of treatment. I guess Jim isn't here, right? Jim, are you here? He's an old friend. Okay. He's on sabbatical? He's out of town. Okay. Well, there aren't any difficulties with these methods. They're perfect. But if one did have to try to find something negative to say about them, maybe it would be that some of the other methods are easier to stabilize than these. At least it seems that way to us. Now, when you do comparisons, you know, your heart is always more in one method than another, so it's never fair. And I suspect if you took the comparisons I'm about to show you and had them redone by experts, things might change. I don't know. I think it's also the case that most use of these methods in history has been second order in time, but not all. And certainly you guys discuss higher orders. Now, the integrating factor approach is not at all well represented by these references. It goes way back in certain fields where you have some kind of a high frequency, maybe a wave-type propagation problem. In various areas where people have had high frequencies in the L, they've used methods like this. The idea is transform the differential equation. Get rid of the high frequency, and formally speaking, that means multiply by e to the minus LT out front. So take this nonlinear equation and turn it into a different nonlinear equation, but in effect, you're analytically getting rid of the linear term. When you first encounter this idea, it just sounds like the solution to everything. It sounds perfect. If you can get rid of the linear term, what more is there to say? In practice, it's not as great as that. It is a good method. It certainly works. But what tends to happen is that the annoying stiffness turns into annoying nonlinearity, and suddenly you have an equation with rapid transients in it, and it's still hard. So you tend to buy something with this method, but you don't eliminate the difficulties at all. We're not aware of how to use it when L is non-diagonal. Maybe some people have done that, but that's another issue. You can describe any of these problems for ordinary differential equations where N and L and N are scalars, but for partial differential equations, you might have a diagonal matrix and you might not. It'll be diagonal if you have, say, a Fourier spectral method, but it will be non-diagonal if you have a Chebyshev spectral method or some multidimensional problem or all kinds of other things. And we don't know if anyone has used methods like these in the non-diagonal case. Do you happen to know? I'm sorry to keep asking the audience, but... See, I've been working on this subject for about a year, and you guys have been in it for longer than that. Now, another very slick and beautiful mathematically method, which is probably the least useful of all of them in practice for high orders, is the split-step approach. Depending what culture you come from, you associate this with different names. If you're a PDE type of person, you think of this as Strang splitting. So Strang had made the observation that if you have two different terms in a PDE, then you might take a step of one and then a step of the other and a step of the first and a step of the other. But you can do better than that if you take a half step of the first and then the other and the first and the first and then at the end a half step. So by using a clever little symmetry, Strang observed that you could turn an approach that's obviously first order into second order. So the idea is just to do time stepping, but have sub-steps with a step for L, a sub-step for L, a sub-step for N, a sub-step for L, and so on. The second order idea is obvious and easy and very practical. But then what about higher order versions of this? And this is really an exotic wilderness. Very nice paper by Yoshida describing some of this work. You can construct split-step methods to have third, fourth, fifth, sixth, whatever order you like, but they get more and more complicated, and I should have written down the coefficients. You find yourself taking sub-steps of crazy lengths. You know, one of them might be of 1/72 of the total step length. You do that much of L, and then you do 0.326 of N, and then 0.145 of L, and so on. Very complicated interleaved patterns. As far as I'm aware, nobody in practice has ever used this stuff except in the specific context of symplectic methods for when you want to conserve certain quantities. But outside that specific area, I don't think anyone uses split-step methods of order higher than 2. To those who've just walked in, the equation we're talking about is in the upper right corner of all these transparencies, mixing stiff linear and nonlinear terms. Now, this is maybe the newest and newest of the various schemes. Bengt Fornberg at Colorado and Toby Driscoll, who is a postdoc with him, had an idea that they call sliders. They never call it that in the paper, but if you ask them, they call this method the method of sliders. I don't know why. But their idea is to take the implicit-explicit approach and refine it a little bit further to make it a little more stable for large step sizes. So they, too, like the linearly implicit people, will use an explicit discretization of the nonlinear term, but then they do exotic things with the linear term. And they split it into 2 or 3 different regions with different wave numbers. So the high frequency, high wave number stuff, they would tend to use a formula that is more stable and maybe less accurate, like Adams-Moulton 2. Then at the low wave numbers, they'll use something which is more accurate and less stable, because you have to resolve that stuff, I guess, like Adams-Bashforth 4. This is kind of an implicit and this an explicit formula. In fact, their original version has 3 regimes. There's high wave numbers, medium wave numbers, and low wave numbers. And at every step, they actually separate out the different Fourier components of their solution, do different things with each step, and put them back together. So it's like linearly implicit, only more so, where you're separating more and more things apart. And it's very impressive when it works. It's really a slick formula. Again, we don't know how to make it work for non-diagonal problems. You have to be able to separate wave numbers to get this thing to work. Now, the last one I'll mention, I don't know anything about, but two papers have just appeared on this subject by a very impressive person, Mike Minion and co-authors. I don't know if they're impressive because I haven't met them, but I know this one's impressive. In fact, like Israel, he's a winner of the 100-digit challenge, so he must be impressive, right? They have what seems like a very basic principle. Why not do a low-order method and then somehow extrapolate? Now, when you read that, it sounds so obvious. What's the point of these other 5 methods? In fact, it's very hard to get things like this to work. But it seems they have found a way to make it work. One of the things that kills you is the old nonlinearity problem. If you do this in the obvious fashion, all the extrapolation is nonlinear. There's a lot of work involved. But they found a way to disentangle the linear and nonlinear and still extrapolate somehow to get high accuracy. So for all I know, that could be the best method in the end. Oh, then we're going to come to the method that I want to tell you about. This slide doesn't really tell you anything, but it's been rediscovered in certain forms many times. We learned about it from these people at Nottingham who wrote a very general analysis of this type of method. Another major paper is by Baelken, Kaiser, and Vozovoy a couple years earlier. I think really those are the 2 most important papers on these exponential time differencing methods, which go by many names. Now, I have a few statements of what they're good and bad for, but I haven't yet told you what they are. Cox and Matthews claim, and as far as we can tell, it's reasonably true, that we have an approach here which combines some of the better features of the integrating factor method and the linearly implicit factor. Remember, integrating factors got rid of the nonlinear term. You just eliminate it. And in some sense, this does that. On the other hand, the linearly implicit methods remove the stiffness by using implicit formulas on the stiff part. And this does that too. And it sort of converges to one in one limit and to the other in another limit. So in some sense, it's a natural combination of the two. Now, of course, I want to tell you a little more about that. So here's the idea of exponential time differencing. And I'm going to compare it to 2 other schemes. So we have our PDE. Now, we're always discretizing in time, so we want to get from time step n to time step n plus 1. And of course, we could write that like this. The difference between the two is the integral of this unknown thing, L of u plus N of u d tau. So when you discretize this PDE, you can interpret your discretization as some sort of approximation to this integral involving an unknown integrand. Now, another way to write that would be to multiply out front by e to the minus tl, as in the integrating factor approach. So convert your PDE to another PDE, and if you do a back-of-the-envelope work, you'll find that that amounts to this. The value at the new time step is the linear propagator times the value at the old time step plus this. So e to the delta tl means the operator that advances you by time delta t for the linear operator exactly. Now, the three methods can all be put in that framework. The linearly implicit approach is using various discrete approximations to these two terms. Maybe an implicit approximation here, an explicit one there. But in both cases, you're approximating something by a polynomial, because all the standard Adams backward differentiation and so on methods, they're all based on polynomial approximations. The integrating factor method does the same thing except to this other formulation. You take this integrand and approximate it by a polynomial. And then the ETD approach, just a slight tweaking of the same idea, amounts to using this formulation but only approximating this thing by the polynomial. Now, it's hard to get excited about that, maybe if you're not used to this stuff, but it has some important effects, because you should think of this as a very large term. Yeah, it's a very high frequency in your problem. It might be there physically in the sense that the solutions are going like this, or it might be there in the stiffness sense that the solutions are smooth but small perturbations would go like that. Either way, this is a high frequency term. It might be hard to approximate that by a polynomial, whereas if you can just approximate a lower frequency bit by a polynomial, that may bring some advantages. And you can, as with all of these methods, you can cook up an Adams-type approach or a Runge-Kutta-type approach based on a particular formulation. Now, I'll show you the actual formulas. I have to tell you the actual story of what happened. So Cox and Matthews wrote this beautiful paper, and there were, as always, referees who disagreed. I was one of the referees. I said it was great. What a wonderful paper. The only thing is, couldn't they do it for Runge-Kutta as well as multi-step? And then the other referee, of course, said, this is a horrible paper. You know, it's bad work. It's a bad idea, and I had it first. You know, the usual complaint. So eventually we did some iterating, and they did develop a Runge-Kutta formula, which I think, in the end, is the most original and important part of the paper. I didn't develop it, but I had a role in persuading them to, so I feel good about that. JCP, Journal of Computational Physics. I'm not going to go through the derivation, which indeed I've never paid any attention to. They used Maple, so it's a good Canadian product. No Runge-Kutta formulas. It has a very much a Runge-Kutta flavor, but a key aspect is the linear part of the problem is being propagated exactly, right? So here's our linear operator, and in this thing we have, well, e to the l, or e to the l over 2, which means exact propagation of the linear operator. In practice, that means taking an exponential of scalars if you've diagonalized with Fourier, or matrices if you haven't diagonalized. So the name of the game here is to do exact linear propagation and blend that as well as possible with the nonlinear stuff. Then you have these magic formulas. You have this crazy stuff and you put it together in completely crazy ways. And I think there's a typo on this line, but you'll never notice. And then at the end, sort of like a Runge-Kutta formula of the type you've seen, you put them all together. The nonlinear term applied to the previous time step and to the various intermediate values, put them all together with these coefficients, which in general are operators, and out comes a new time step value, which can be shown to be fourth order accurate. So it's a fourth order accurate discretization of this problem That's just a mathematical statement. Then the question is, how good is it in practice? I'm about to show you some comparison, but I should slow down and ask if there are any questions. Preferably from people who don't know this subject, so they won't embarrass me, but if necessary, you can ask too.
So the linear operator doesn't have to be, it could be an integral operator too?
It could, that's right, absolutely. Yeah, we haven't tried anything like that, but anything you can discretize. And to a spectral person, anything linear can be discretized effectively exactly. If it's smooth. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so I don't want to make you foreshadow.
Uh-huh.
It looks so far that you can only handle L's that you can diagonalize.
Ah.
Are you missing something, or is no, there
we,
more to come?
No, there is more to come. We definitely do not just handle L's that you can diagonalize. We've done both 1D Chebyshev-type things where you get dense matrices and also two-dimensional Fourier-type things where you can diagonalize in each dimension but not across. And so it doesn't have to be diagonalizable. On the other hand, if you had matrices that were really huge, there might be a problem. To continue the foreshadowing, we're taking exponentials of matrices that might be of dimensions in the hundreds, but you do it once and for all at the beginning, so the cost is not so bad. In fact, it's abundantly worth it. Okay, so I want to show you some pictures comparing some of these schemes for four problems. Now, the first problem, these are straight from my student, Ali Kassam. This is good old Berger's equation. You all know Berger's equation, even if you don't know how to spell burgers and whether there's an apostrophe. So it's a shock equation, and then there's a little bit of viscosity to smooth out the shocks. So this is L and this is N, and you've all seen pictures like this. The initial condition is smooth, but it forms an approximate shock, the width of the shock being determined by epsilon. So Ali coded up, in each of these pictures, he got as many of the methods to work as he could. So whenever a curve is missing, the precise significance of that is my student could not get the method to work. The deeper significance is up to you. I think in some cases the method doesn't work. You're never sure, really, are you? Every plot, I should have written this bigger, shows the same data almost in two different senses. You have error on a log scale. This is step size, and this is computer time. So in every case, the left-hand picture shows things sloping this way because as you shrink the time step, you get lower errors. And the right picture shows that as you take more computer time, you get lower errors. The slopes are always 4 because whenever it wasn't 4, we kept working till it was 4. So everything is a fourth-order convergence. And so you're very typically seeing convergence down to 10 or 12 digits. Now, what do you see when you look here? Well, one thing you notice is that there are some differences in these methods, not very dramatic. In this particular problem, Ali had real trouble getting the linearly implicit stuff to work at larger time steps. So he was unable to get to avoid stability problems for larger time steps. That's why this curve begins here. Now, I would guess if you guys tried it, something else might happen. I don't know. But at any rate, he found stability troubles for the larger time steps. And then we have this mysterious thing that it seemed to be about 10 times more time-consuming for reasons we're not entirely sure of for this particular equation. So on this equation, the ETD is always in black. The slider method and the integrating factor all seemed very close together, and the linearly implicit seemed not competitive, both on time and stability. The second of the four problems we tried was good old KdV, Korteweg-de Vries, and this is the, well, you know, you take every decade in history and ask what was the most important bit of mathematics that decade, applied mathematics, of course. In the 1970s, this was it. Nonlinear waves were the sexiest topic in applied mathematics in the 1970s, and this is the canonical nonlinear wave equation. Solitons form, you don't see them interacting here really, but of course they do sometimes. So again, that's space and that's time. So we did a comparison of the various methods for a particular KdV problem. And here's what we found this time. So in this case, he was able to get three of the methods to work. Integrating factor, ETD, and the sliders. And I guess, what's the conclusion? They're all fairly comparable. In no case did we try deferred correction. That we haven't looked at. But I guess he wasn't able to get the linearly implicit stuff to work. And what's the other one I'm omitting there? Split step is so ugly, that's really hard to get that to work. But he heroically achieved it for some problems. And now here we have the Michael Ward equation. Alan Kahn, also known as, is it there's another name. Kolmogorov. What, Michael, where are you? What's that? Isn't that slightly different? I'm forgetting. But there's certainly a Russian name for it, right? Isn't there a Kolmogorov and somebody? But anyway, so here you have an equation with, again, a small parameter in front of a viscous term, and then the reaction term is one that has two stable points of attraction. Both 1 and minus 1 attract solutions to this equation, where 0 is unstable. And so I'm sure many of you have seen pictures like this of the metastability phenomenon. This is space and this is time. So the initial condition very quickly for this problem settles into a more or less stable state, which in this particular experiment then suddenly goes away at a certain time, leaving you with the actual asymptotic state. If you change epsilon ever so slightly, the effect on the metastable time is exponential. So you can very easily cook up Alan Kahn equations where you seem to be in a steady state, but mathematically you're not. So that was our third test problem. As always, black is ETD and blue is linearly implicit. So here's a case where the linearly implicit method seems to do better. We did get the split step method to work for small time steps, but you can see this is a typical stiff problem. We can't get it to work at all for larger time steps. That's the hallmark of stiffness, right? You can only succeed if you resolve the thing to death. You don't see the other methods there because this particular problem is non-diagonal. We have a Chebyshev discretization because it's non-periodic. And so the integrating factor method doesn't work, and also the slider method doesn't work.
How long was that computed? Sorry, but what's the time scale? The maximum time?
I think it's actually a fairly... say it again.
What's the T there? Is that 10 to the 10? Or is that, you know, or what's the epsilon, you know? Is that, like, what's the time?
I think T here is 80, and epsilon is something not astronomically small, of course. I don't remember how small. It's not 10 to the minus 6th at all.
Fat transition length, so
right. Yeah. But, of course, you might also ask, where are we sampling? Is it actually at the end of this computation that we're computing our errors? I don't remember. The last one for the comparison is the Kuramoto-Sivashinsky, which I already showed you. That now is on a periodic domain again, so it is a Fourier discretization. And for this, he managed to get four of the methods to work. As always, ETD works easily. And I know this sounds biased, but the truth is we found it was effortless to get that to work for all of these equations. And sometimes some of the others took real work. Split steps is the hairiest, but the others, too, had some real problems. In this case, what you see is that ETD is looking very nice. It's doing well as a function of time step and also in computer time. Okay, so that's... like all of these comparisons, nothing is ever certain. But what is clear? Well, we have a scheme that works very nicely, ETD. Some of the competition doesn't even claim to work for non-diagonal problems, so that's another ironclad fact, I guess. The other stuff is open to interpretation. Now, let me tell you some of the mathematical fun we've had along the way. So, Cox and Matthews derived this class of methods, but also others like Baelken et al. Have worked on them, and without a doubt, when you derive these things, you come up against a huge problem of cancellation. So you remember these crazy formulas involving the linear propagator. L would be e to the time step times the linear term. You have these crazy formulas. Well, what these are more complicated formulas along the lines of this. So just think for a moment of e to the x minus 1 over x. Well, you can all see by doing a Taylor series that the 1 cancels, right? So we're left with the remainder of the Taylor series of e to the x, but then we divide by x to get 1 plus so-and-so. So if you had to evaluate this on a computer, it wouldn't be that hard. You could think of ways to do it. But you'd have to be a little bit careful when x was near 0 so that you didn't lose information to cancellation. Now, these are like fourth-order or third-order analogs of that. You can imagine if I took the first 3 terms in the Taylor series of e to the x and then divided by x cubed, I'd have a very difficult formula there because the numerator would now have cancellation to third order. For any particular scalar x, you can certainly find a way to evaluate such a thing. If necessary, you could do a test to find out if x is close to 0, use a Taylor series. If it's far from 0, don't use a Taylor series, something like that. But that takes a lot of deciding how to do things, and it doesn't work if x isn't a scalar. If x is a matrix blending together eigenvalues near 0 and eigenvalues far from 0, how do you evaluate a formula like that? So it's a real challenge. And in general, these are matrices. So we have third-order analogs of that involving matrices. They just don't work at all if you try to plug it into the formula. Now, Cox and Matthews mostly stuck to examples where that issue didn't arise, but then they recommended you could try Taylor series when the issue did arise, assuming X is a scalar. So they're in the diagonalizable context. Baelkin went much further. They had methods which were thoroughly reliable, but in our view, very specialized for particular formulas. So we'd like to recommend that for all kinds of problems like this, there's a general technique that works very slickly. It's probably never the very fastest possible, but it's so general and easy that it's worth knowing about. And that's to use contour integrals. So let me explain what I mean. You've all taken a complex analysis course. You all remember Cauchy's integral formula. So it should be plausible that you can do a Cauchy integral for a matrix or operator as well as a scalar. So if you have an analytic function f of a matrix or operator, you can write that as 1 over 2 pi I times an integral over a contour in the complex plane. The contour has to enclose the spectrum of L, and the integral is f of t, that's just a scalar, times this matrix, the resolvent, dt. So this is very well-known stuff in functional analysis. Functions of matrices and operators are most elegantly defined, really, as these contour integrals over contours that surround the spectrum. Now, in practice, you can often simply take a circle that encloses the spectrum. Or if it's an unbounded operator, you might sometimes want to take a big parabola that extends to minus infinity in the complex plane. But for the versions I'm going to show you, we just take a circle. Now you have an integral then over a circle in the complex plane. And the point is, that circle can be far from a difficult point. If zero is unstable because of cancellation, just stay away from there. And the problems just go away if you use the circle rather than the difficult point. Now, how do you evaluate an integral on a circle in the complex plane? Well, you discretize it by the trapezoid rule and you get spectral accuracy. This is something very well known for many years, that smooth functions, analytic functions, on periodic or closed contours can be discretized with geometrically small errors just by adding up values at equally spaced points. So what we do in practice is to just find a circle that's sufficiently large to enclose the spectrum and take 32, 64, in fact, often fewer points than that, and just do whatever computations are necessary to add up these 32 or whatever matrices or vectors. You do that once and for all before the time stepping, And then from this magic procedure, you have thoroughly stable matrices that do everything you want for the ETD method. Yes, Brian?
So this is something you do for the A, the B, the C.
Yes, right. In fact, every problem in practice, except maybe nonlinear Schrodinger, involves real arithmetic, so there's another factor of two symmetry you can exploit. Just use the top half of your circle and then take the real part of the result. But that doesn't matter. It's all preliminary computation anyway. So now I'm going to hand out a code. Pass these around. I better keep one. And I'm going to put on the computer. Can you press down the red button? That may have to do a translation. Okay, can you slide it along?
Yeah, there's a few other things in here.
Can you slide the projector along to there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Nick, if you use more and more points, does your operator L have an unbounded, the spectrum can be unbounded, or they always line a compact region so you can choose the big circle ultimately?
Yeah.
I think it's usually in a compact region, but I'm sure you could find examples of both sorts. But for these, I'm... As I say that, I'm wondering why, and I forget why, but that is how it turned out. Okay, so of course we're talking to MATLAB, my favorite conversational partner. Okay, if you take a look at this, I trust you're all fluent in MATLAB. Look first at the side labeled contour. And I just want to show you an example, unrelated to stiff PDEs, but just an example of evaluating a matrix function by a contour integral. And like all of these contour integrals, it really reduces just to a mean over equally spaced points. So we'll just go through this code. It's trying to compute the square root of a matrix times a vector. So n equals 30. Okay, that's the dimension of my matrix. A equals rand n over square root of n. I'm cooking up a matrix whose spectrum is a bunch of dots in a circle of radius 1 about the point 2. So the sketch here suggests the 30 points in the spectrum of A. Then I'm going to evaluate the square root of A by this contour integral using a circle of radius 1.5 around 2. And I'm going to do that for various numbers of grid points. So first of all, I can compute the exact solution by using MATLAB's built-in command square root m. So that's the effectively exact square root of the matrix. And I multiply it times the right-hand side. And now, for 4, 8, 16, and so on points, I set up the equally spaced points on that circle. And then I just add up the appropriate thing. So if you look at the handwritten mathematics there, I'll just take you through that derivation. The function of the matrix we're dealing with is the square root. So we want to compute square root of A times B. That's 1 over 2 pi I times a contour integral. The integral is in the Z variable, or this is Canada, it's the Z variable. If we set Z equals Z naught plus 1.5 e to the I, in Canada, is it theta or theta? Oh, God. So in America, it's Z equals E to the I theta. In England, it's... No, Z equals E to the I theta. In England, it's Z equals E to the I theta. And in Canada, Z equals E to the I theta. Okay. differentiate dz equals I times E minus Z minus Z naught. What that boils down to, as I say, like so many Cauchy integrals in the simple context, is just a mean over a bunch of roots of unity. So all this code is doing is taking the mean over 8 or 16 or whatever points of a certain vector. I haven't used the fact that everything's real, so there's a factor of 2 that I haven't exploited. And if I type contour now, I don't know if you can see these numbers. This is a Pentium 1, so the speed can be ignored. What you see is that with 4 points, it's no good. 16 points, I'm getting a few digits. By the time I'm up to 128 points, I have machine precision, or equivalently, I could have used 64 points. Well, that's not such a thrilling demonstration, so let's move along to the other side of this sheet of paper. Where am I here? where I do Kuramoto-Sivashinsky equation. Now, I'm not going to walk you through this code, but you can see the highlights. There are two main sections of the code. The first is the pre-computation, where we do all this clever stuff with the contour integrals. And this problem happens to be diagonal, so this is really a trivial thing. But more generally, that might be a significant amount of your computation. You might spend 10% of your time on this pre-computing stage because of the matrices you have to deal with. So here you can see the four magic formulas displayed kind of nicely there. In every case, Q, A, B, and C is a real of a mean of something. And that mean simply means I'm taking roots of unity or equally spaced points on an appropriate circle, and I'm evaluating the appropriate thing on those points, and then just taking the mean over all of that. So this is my stable method that avoids cancellation errors for computing these magic coefficients. Then once you've got them, you just go through a time-stepping loop that looks like any old Runge-Kutta method, basically. The complexity here is that we're working in Fourier space, so I keep bouncing back and forth into space-space to evaluate the nonlinear term. And then, as always in MATLAB, in four lines of plotting commands, you can make it very pretty. If you run this on a real machine, it takes about a third of a second. But on this, it's going to take 6 or 8 seconds, I think. So if I type KS for Kuramoto-Sivashinsky, you see this thing computed to very high precision for the particular problem you've seen earlier on the screen. Let me make a comment about this particular choice of initial data. It's periodic, and we've picked initial data that happen to have the property that because of a certain symmetry, this remains straight forever. Now, actually, we could only get up to about 150 before the sensitivity of the problem kills us. You need the super high accuracy of this formula in order to get this correct, because it's a chaotic problem. Small perturbations are being amplified exponentially. To illustrate that, you can see there's a line in the code beginning with a percent sign, which means it's been commented out. So let's comment it back in. That will change the initial condition slightly. Where am I here? Oh, come on. Am I in the wrong place? Oh, God. sorry, where have I put this program? Thought it was here. Yeah. Why isn't it? Maybe I won't be able to do this because I'm not good enough at Windows. Isn't it right there? Tell me, can we raise your hand if that looks like ks.empty? What am I doing wrong?
You've got a space.
Okay. Right, thank you. You guys, that's pretty embarrassing that you all recognize that space. A bunch of nerds in this room. Okay, so I'll comment that back in. Right. And I'll run it again. So now we've perturbed the initial data by about 1% to break the symmetry that makes that line straight. And you can see it's now wiggling beautifully. So again, this is, I suspect, correct to plotting accuracy over the time range indicated. Now, just a couple of final remarks, but I need to find them.
Maybe here.
Oh, yes, right. Good. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to come back to this, so let's leave it where it is, but just a little more word.
I want to use the other projector, maybe.
You think so? Okay, give it a try. It's only a couple of things. I wanted to show you more about the Kuramoto-Sivashinsky. When you have a chaotic system like this, naturally, you'd like to study how chaotic it is, what's the Lyapunov exponent, which means how fast the perturbations grow. And in order to do that in a way that you're confident of, you need a high accuracy method like this, which you think really is getting the right answer. So here's just a still of the same kind of picture I've been showing you. I believe in this case, Ali computed it just as before, and then he changed the initial conditions by 10 to the minus 8th, I think it was. So you can see the magic straight line is preserved for a while, but then that symmetry is visibly broken. And here he's showing you the rate of amplification of perturbations for this problem. So as time goes by for this particular run, the perturbations are growing obviously at an exponential rate on average, and if you fit that curve, you get a particular slope, and that's the Lyapunov exponent for this problem, presumably. Of course, it's not a proof, it's a numerical computation. Oh, I guess here he's done a perturbation of size 10 to the minus 6th and shown you the effect at time 150 is to completely change the solution. The last thing I wanted to do was show you some pictures from another equation called the Gray-Scott equations. How many of you have heard of those? Okay. I'm not going to write them down, but the Gray-Scott equations are a pair of coupled reaction diffusion equations. And in the biology world, very often you have coupled equations. Alan Turing is the one who made that idea famous. He discovered that in certain contexts, coupled reaction diffusion equations could generate patterns. So the Gray-Scott equations are a set of equations that do that, and I just thought I'd show you for fun a couple of movies that Ali computed for those equations. So let's see, where are we? AKK movies, okay. Have any of you seen this website at Caltech called Exmorphia? Okay, so I should write that down because it's more fun than this talk. Do a Google on Exmorphia. And you'll be led to a website at Caltech, which is really gorgeous, illustrating the behavior of these Gray-Scott equations for various parameters. Now, when you have reaction diffusion equations that form patterns, you typically find that small changes in the parameters may have huge qualitative effects on the patterns that evolve. So you change a parameter a few percent, and instead of generating spots, the system generates stripes. And the biologists have made good publicity out of this. You know, why does the zebra have its spot, or is it zebra in Canada? Zebra. Well, why is this? Right. Does a zebra have spots or stripes in Canada? Right. Why do animals have stripes or spots? And why is it that maybe the zebra or zebra has stripes on the legs and spots? No, some of these animals have stripes on the legs and spots on the body. That might be the giraffe or something. You can see I'm a theorist. Speaking very generally, the answer is that small changes in parameters can have these huge effects. And that means, from an evolutionary point of view, natural selection doesn't have to change the mechanism to change from stripes to spots. It merely has to adjust a parameter. So the Exmorphia website is a beautiful picture of the Gray-Scott equations in parameter space. And there are two parameters, and in each spot in space, you see the type of pattern that emerges from that. It's really wonderful. If you click on the little red dots, you see a still, and if you click on the big yellow squares, you see a movie showing you this stuff. But it's also true that people have questioned whether their computations are accurate. Qualitatively, they're right, of course, but are they quantitatively right? There's some dispute about that. And, of course, the answer is you need high-accuracy methods like ETD-RK4, to resolve such questions. So I just thought I'd show you a couple of movies with one choice of parameters. You get something that looks like a brain, I guess, right? Come on. So here we are in the Gray-Scott equations with a particular choice of parameters, and you can see them evolving. This is all computed with the ETD-RK4 method. I think I can... Oh, what did I do? That ought to work. How do I play now? I know what I do. So with a particular choice of parameters, you start with some more or less arbitrary data in the middle, and then you let time evolve, and you can see that for this choice of parameters, we're getting roll type of structures, which are at least metastable. They don't move too much in the interior, but they keep moving out. Then the other one I'm going to show you is just another choice of parameters for the same thing. If I can stop this, I may fail in doing that, in which case the talk is over. Right. What happens if I click here? Okay. The scale of the picture is different, so these spots are actually much smaller than they look. But you can see that qualitatively, although the parameters have only changed a little bit, I think maybe F changed from 0.005 to 0.003, the behavior looks utterly different. So, just to repeat what I said a moment ago, if you want to do experiments on a computer that you can be confident are really right for equations like this, you need a high accuracy method, and we think that the ETDRK4 is a very nice one that can handle all kinds of problems like this. Okay, so thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm ready. You're ready for questions.
He's ready for questions.
Any questions, comments?
Michael.
Actually, when I'm thinking of metastability, or I'm thinking of a similar phenomena to the Gray-Scott model that occurs for the gear of my heart, one of the things that's kind of needed is to be able to dynamically change the time step, such as when a layer collapse phenomenon is occurring, that's a very fast time step. Yet when nothing is happening, you can take a huge time step without losing accuracy. So how can you do that with this method? Because that would be fantastic.
So if you program things like this, you find that any multi-step method is just a pain, and any Runge-Kutta method is delightful. And in particular, for things like that, if it's Runge-Kutta, yes, this kind of thing is relatively easy, because each step is independent. So I haven't done that. I don't know precisely what I'd do, but I should think it would be eminently possible, yes.
You're using backward differentiation formulas, because at least for metastability, the eigenvalues are usually real, but they're in the negative real axis near the origin.
Yes, right.
And so that's actually not so much.
Yeah. Brian?
Well, just you could, every time you want a different time step, you just have to recompute these matrices, right?
Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. I should have said that. Yeah, so... So maybe you'd want to do a set of them related by factors of 2 in advance or something, and then you'd have a collection of 10 to choose from. Yeah. Yeah.
All your linear operators have basically constant coefficients.
The ones I've shown you do. Now, in fact, the formulas by Cox, Matthews, and Belkin and all don't depend on that. They have a variant for variable coefficients. Yeah.
Time,
right. So there are two kinds of variability. There's time and space. Space doesn't matter at all. Time matters in the sense that you might have to do extra work. So I think it would be in many cases. Right. So I'm not really recommending these for those problems. Unless you have an ODE or something. If it's a diagonal problem, sure, it'll work.
So for these integrals, can you use residues?
Well, in a way, you already are, because if you look on the two sides of this sheet, you'll find two different formulas that look superficially different. One's an integral with a resolvent; the other's just a mean. How would you get from one to the other? Well, it would be a residue, actually. Whether you could do it in some more explicit way, I don't know. Michael.
Right, one more. I have pictures for the gear of Meinhard model whereby, like you had this last picture of your spots,
right,
where the spot is pulsating up and down,
yeah,
on a fast, let's say, an order one time scale, yet the spot drifts very, very slowly towards some equilibrium location in space. So then you really want to compute like an envelope of the oscillations out. So you really want kind of long time. Is there a good method? Is Runge-Kutta, would that be good for that?
You know? Well, that's a whole other question, isn't it? So I'm telling you how to solve a PDE in a time-accurate fashion. You're asking a much more advanced question of how to homogenize or something. I know nothing about that subject. Right. Okay. Steve didn't say anything. We're ruthless.
He'll wait until after.
Okay, he'll wait.
Okay, thank you very much, Nick.